Hello, my name's Tamsin Westall and welcome to Fresh from the Pod. In this episode, I meet garden historian Adfili Richmond. You may well have seen her featured on Gardener's World. And we talk about her passion for learning and sharing knowledge, changing her career at 40, jigsaw puzzles, her supportive husband, going to a Queen's garden party, and incredibly, her dislike of history as a child. So Adfili, lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you too, Tamsin.
And as usual, you look fabulous. I've got to say, I'm always so excited to see what colour headscarf you're wearing. They are beautiful.
Thank you.
So
Thank you.
Have like racks of different fabric in your room?
I have hundreds of, because I've got a dressing room and I've got loads and loads of headscarves and wraps and whatever. If I see a piece of fabric that I like, or a remnant, for instance. Well, I mean, this particular one, just the colours caught my eye. And then I realised it's actually, I think it's tulips. Tulips. But I have an awful lot of them.
So yes. It's an addiction as well as your garden. So we're sitting in your study, looking out at your garden.
Yes.
It's looking very spring-like.
Yes, it is. I'm slightly ahead of myself on this side of the garden. However, the other end is a different story altogether. But that was purely because we had such a gorgeous sort of 2 weeks after Christmas and I actually managed to get out. But since then, with all the rain, the ground is just saturated.
Yes, it's not been good.
But because I spend so much time in here, I make sure that this section of the garden is looking good.
So room with a view.
Yes, exactly.
A very appropriate view.
Absolutely.
So this is obviously a really busy time for you, isn't it?
It is, yes.
How are your days filled? How does a garden historian fill her days?
Yeah, I just spend my time just reading and making notes and learning and then go to archives, go to the library. I just do what I want, basically. I am in the middle of writing a couple of new talks for later this year and next year.
So would you describe yourself as an academic?
I personally don't describe myself as an academic. Everybody else does.
Yeah, as a mere gardener that I am, a weeding girl, I'm thinking this sounds very, very sensible to me.
No, I just, you know, I do what interests me. Okay, so I've got an MA in garden history. I've done quite a lot of continuous development courses. I've got all of that. So to all intents and purposes, I am an academic, but I don't call myself an academic. I'm a historian. I'm interested in all sorts of things. And if something takes my fancy, then I will start looking into it and I'll start writing about it. So at the moment, I'm writing a lecture on Edwardian Japanese gardens, or how they came about, because a lot of people sort of think they sort of exploded in 1910 when they had the Japanese exhibition in London. But they had been around since about 1850.
Gosh, really?
And so I'm writing about how they sort of peaked when the Japanese exhibition came about. And so you start learning. My passion is learning and then passing that knowledge onto other people.
It's almost like, I can imagine it's like being a detective, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And you find the murderer that no one else knew. It's terrible, isn't it? But, you know, this is my level, you can tell. But, you know, it's sort of like, you know, your study's very Sherlock Holmes-esque. And you're sort of trying to get to the bottom of things that maybe no one's ever looked at before.
Or thought about.
Yeah. So does that give you a buzz to investigate things that just have been sort of forgotten or just not seen as important?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love jigsaw puzzles. Anyway, that is a bit of a tradition we have here at Christmas. We always have a jigsaw. And all the family sort of, but I love that, you know, just getting the pieces together.
I have one I'm going to send you.
It's a Marmite pot.
I was going to say.
And it's the hardest puzzle. My sister's doing it at the moment. It comes in a Marmite pot. It's huge and it's killing her. It's the hardest puzzle she's ever done. So I'm sending it your way. Next Christmas, the Marmite pot will arrive.
But there's just this, I don't know, there's this sense of achievement when you find what you're looking for. I mean, for instance, I've got Slow Burn Project at the moment. I've been researching this Victorian botanist for about 5 years now.
So he was called Reverend
Thomas Birch Freeman.
I looked him up. He was rather dishy, actually.
Yes.
I thought, gosh, I can see why she's researching him.
I've been given special permission to actually look at his original journals by the Methodist Church. And reading through these journals, it's like sitting there talking to him, and you know, and you come across sort of a list of plants, and the excitement, it's really hard to describe, but the excitement of actually finding something that is confirming what you thought, because he was a missionary and he went out to West Africa, but he was, of mixed race. It's quite interesting, the sort of the portrait, which is actually in the a National Gallery. Mm. He does come across as quite a sort of handsome. He was about 6 foot two, and he just comes across as somebody that I would love to just sit and have. And well, he didn't drink, so a cup of tea then, a nice cup of tea with him, and because his legacy is purely from a religious perspective, but he did collect plants, you know, and he did correspond with sort of Q. He did all of this, but it has never been written about. The 5 books have been written about him, but they all miss out all the horticultural stuff.
Oh, wow. So you can add, but it must be almost like communicating with the dead. Do you feel like, I mean, that sounds a bit, but
creepy.
Yeah, but you are, it, you know, you hope one day maybe someone in 200 years time will be researching you.
Oh, that'd be fabulous. You never know, do you? Oh.
You hadn't thought about that, had you?
I hadn't, no.
They might listen to this, well, this podcast, will it be around in 200 years time?
I know.
Nice thought. But how on earth did you get into this? So how did you first of all think, right, I'm going to be a garden historian?
Well, I didn't. It's all, everything just sort of tends to happen to me. Mm. And I was working as a buyer, and I just found that I really didn't want to be doing that. Instead, by the time I was 40, I didn't want to be doing what I was doing. Although I enjoyed it, it was how it was. So I started an RHS course, night school, evening classes. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I actually thought, you know, gardening, I would like to become a gardener. So I went through that and I finished level 2. By that stage, we moved from Derbyshire down here to Shropshire. So I enrolled at Rees Heath to carry on.
Yeah.
And when I actually got there, we had this wonderful, wonderful lecturer, Harry Delaney. Oh, he was just something else. But what he did, because we had to do, I mean, you probably know all about the RHS courses.
I taught it.
And did you?
Level 1,
the plant idents. Yes. Oh, my word. Anyway, and I loved it. And I loved the idents, although the evergreens, the trees were always a bit
tricky.
Iffy.
Conifers.
Oh, God.
Very
even now,
tricky.
Even now, no. I look at them and I go, oh, yeah, okay, whatever. Anyway, but what he used to do with the idents is that he would say, oh, this is forsythia or what? And then he'll tell you a little bit about the history.
Ah, I see.
And I was sitting there thinking,
it's more interesting.
Plants have history. Now, that's interesting. Anyway, so I started talking to him about it. And so he gave me loads and loads of information about plant hunters and that kind of thing. And in amongst the plant hunters were also landscape designers, you know, and And I sort of thinking, this is really interesting. So I had a word with him, and he contacted somebody at Pershore, and they allowed me to drop in to this HND course.
Yeah.
I think I dropped in just for the garden history module. That was it. I was absolutely hooked. And then I did a sort of foundation degree in heritage horticulture because I was sort of thinking I really want to know more about the history of plants. And then I sort of heard about the garden history MA at Bristol. And I thought, I'll give it a go. The rest is history.
And so was your husband supportive in this? Did he think, mine would think, oh no, what now? What's the latest fad? Has he sort of been excited by it?
He's been absolutely fabulous. He's been brilliant. He's been so supportive. It's incredible. I mean, my RHS exams, I mean, he'll be there testing me and, you know, sort of.
It's like a driving test, isn't it?
Yes. And, you know, and sort of the turf module. Oh, please, the turf module.
I love it. See, I'm a greenkeeper. I love turf. Oh, I know, we're very different.
You know, learning, one of the things that it was sort of having to learn the grasses and, you know, with hindsight, it was actually really, really, I'm really glad, you know, I did actually do all of that because it does come into its own even now.
It gives you that grounding, doesn't it?
It does give you that grounding, but oh, the droplets when you're spraying, how many droplets, but you know, it wasn't sexy enough for me. Greenkeeping wasn't sexy. And so he's been incredibly supportive over the years. The way he looks at it is that through what I do, he ends up doing things that he would never have dreamt.
Because he's not a horticulturalist, is he?
No. Well, he's an engineer. And so things like going to the Queen's Garden Party, because I'm a trustee of the Welsh Historic Gardens Trust. So 2 years ago, I went and represented because the Prince of Wales is our patron. And, you know, so we get to go to the Queen's Garden Party. We go a chance to go to Dublin and, you know, party hard in some of the Georgian squares, and you know, we get to do the most amazing things through what I do, and he just sort of tags along and just laps it up and enjoys, you know, being involved. So yes, it's now, you know, I'm now sort of almost, I don't know, self-sufficient now, but he's been very supportive.
But did you think that, you know, from getting this interest, that it would change your life like this? You know, that every day would be consumed.
Oh, my goodness me. No, I didn't. Because it's interesting. And I know this sounds daft, but a lot of people don't know what a garden historian is.
Right.
The amount of time I get asked, oh, what do you do? Oh, I'm a garden historian. Have you designed any gardens I might have heard of? And it is interesting. And I gave a talk the other day. And when they were introducing me, this lovely lady said, I didn't even know there was such a thing as garden history.
Really?
And I think what it is with a lot of people, organisations tend to focus on the buildings, the houses, that infrastructure. And gardens historically have played second fiddle. They haven't. So
probably due to funding a lot of the time, isn't it, as well?
I think it's just not, they hadn't realised the importance of gardens, because when you, even now, when you go to certain places, certain archives or libraries, garden history is found under architecture.
Ah, gosh. Right, okay.
Because it was just this
not deemed important
addition. Though. Is part of the house. And so when garden history as a genre, as a subject, sort of started taking off, I think Roy Strong was quite heavily involved in that. It is still, even now, it's still a very new discipline.
Mm. So what do you hope? Do you hope that people come to your lectures and think, oh, I'm going to go and do a qualification, or I'm going to go and look at a property and a garden in a different way?
I am a huge believer, as I said, in sharing knowledge. And so what we have developed with the help of a few colleagues from Gardens Trust and an organisation called Grapevine, which I belong to, we've sort of put together an introductory garden history in 10 objects. So yeah. If you look around sort of my study and sort of in the hall, there's some objects like the gnome up there and...
There is a gnome in your study. I love it. It's watching over you from very high up there.
Yeah, it's a gnome. So one of them, and you've got a little red bridge.
Yeah.
And so I have objects.
And you talk around them.
And we talk about the objects. And it's an interactive day. People get to handle these things and they have to sort of decide, you know, what is it? What, you know, what's the significance? And that's a day. And then I do sort of like an hour and a half overview, putting each object in context, sort of from 15th century to 1940.
Yeah.
And that is a taster. So you're covering sort of 5,000 years in an hour and a half.
Great way.
And then I offer a 6-week course. Again, an introduction to garden history.
And what sort of people do you get on the 6-week course?
All walks of life.
I bet it's quite eclectic, isn't it? Age ranges and different interests.
Do you know, it's really peculiar. Women. Mm-hmm. It is women. I think we've had about 4 men out of about 48 people. And it is quite interesting. So they then come onto this course and so next week I'm taking a group of 6-week student that have been on the 6-week course, which finished in September last year. So I'm taking them to the Shrewsbury Archives on Monday, where they're going to have taken out sort of garden history related material in the county. And several of them had expressed an interest in researching. So by taking them to the archives, and they'll be shown how to use the material.
Yeah, I think that is a stumbling block. I would be sort of, oh gosh, can I? Am I allowed? What does it involve? It's like a sort of mystery.
Exactly.
Area.
And I want people to do research. There is so much out there still to be discovered. Mm. And that's what I want to do, give them the tools to do it. And so by taking them to the archives, I'm introducing them to the archivists that are there. And that gives them the confidence to walk in there again by themselves, knowing their way around the archives. Because it's terrifying. Oh, even now when I go to a new archive, it can be quite daunting, actually.
I can imagine.
So hopefully the 3 or 4 people that have expressed an interest in doing further research, they will then carry on. And then we're now following them up with sort of key study days on particular subjects just to keep everything ticking along. So as new people come through each year, you know, we are hopefully, you know, getting a few more garden historians. In the pipeline.
Incredibly worthwhile. And it's about people again, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, most of the podcasts I do, whether you're a gardener, a designer, it all comes back down to working with people and sharing knowledge. And
absolutely. Absolutely. Because the more people that know and understand the significance of historic gardens, the more people there are to protect them.
Yeah.
That's where I'm coming from. That's sort of, you know.
So when you were at school, where were you at school?
I was at school in Somerset.
Right. So was history a thing for you?
I hated it.
Never. Mind you, I hated school, did you?
I hated school for a completely different reason. Being the only black family in the whole, probably in the county, I think, comes with its own baggage. Mm. But history, all I can remember are the Stuarts. And we did them for what felt
years.
Like years. Even now, I do think that history should be taught from... there should be a lot more social content.
Yeah, because it draws children in, doesn't it? If they can relate
exactly.
to it and think, oh, gosh, could I live like that? Or what, you know, what would they have eaten? And
exactly. I think that's why I brought social history into my garden history, because gardens, they're created. You've got so many elements in garden history that affect the outcome of a garden. You got people travel and they discover gardens. They come back and they copy them. Politics, Italy, I mean, Italian Renaissance era is one of my passions. In Italy, most of the glorious gardens that you even see now, most of them were created by popes, cardinals, you know, religious people and politicians. And it's the same in this country. All you have to do is think of some of the iconic historic gardens. Most of them were created by politicians or religious. You know, this garden history encompasses everything. And so when I talk to people, I explain how a garden came about and why. So it could be, for instance, that went on their grand tour, you know, common. You go out and you spend 4, 5, 6, 7 years out in Italy traveling around the place and you're collecting your treasures for your country house and you're learning to have polite conversation in polite society. You bring back your paintings, you bring back your statues. You might have spotted my dying gladiator in the hall. That was a statue that was brought back, life-size ones. Hundreds and hundreds of them were brought back. And you find them in the most intriguing places. Next time you go to Iford Manor, have a look on the gate going into the kitchen garden. There's a dying gladiator, life-size, that Harold Peter brought back from Italy. And it's things like that that people sort of sit up and take notice of, and they think, oh, I saw one of those in such and such. That is all part of garden history.
Obviously, you've been to my garden, Stocktonbury.
Yes, it's
and
lovely.
What I love is my uncle, who's been there since he was, I don't know, he was born there. And he has, occasionally, he'll drop in things from the past. And I think, what if I didn't know that? What if he went to his grave and I didn't know that?
I know.
So the other day he was telling me that during the war, the evacuees came from Liverpool. Mm-hmm. They stayed in our barn, my great aunt's, on straw beds. And a headmistress came and taught the children in our house. But her husband was disabled and he spent the war cutting kindling in our reception area where you come to the garden.
Really?
Wearing a bowler hat. So he spent the entire war chopping wood for local people. And you think, it's such a great story. Now, every time I walk in there, I think of him.
The other thing is that people sometimes they don't think it's relevant.
Or they think
it's not interesting.
Yeah.
And you think, oh my goodness, you know.
and we've got a pillar in the garden, in the driveway. And I said, what, this has been knocked? He said, oh yeah, that was a tank. I said, a what? He said, yeah, in the war, they came to size up our property and Barrington Hall, the Americans.
Oh, really?
I was like, what?
Oh, my goodness.
I know, it's just, how can he casually drop that into a conversation? And then I'm sort of jumping around and, you know, but it's getting people to share that knowledge because they may not see that it's important, but it is so important.
It is. It's incredibly important. And I just, you know, and I like talking to elderly people as well.
I know.
I love it. You know, I'm quite happy to sort of, you know, talk to whoever. And the information that you get from them, as I say, they don't think anybody else is interested.
I find strange, but maybe they haven't been interested for a while. Maybe we're more interested now.
Possibly,
than ever before. I wonder if, I think we might be, which is very exciting.
I mean, and I love the whole idea of oral history. I mean, this is what this is really, to a certain extent. Mm. That whole business of teaching people to record, talking to their grandparents or talking to a great aunt or whatever. I'm a huge fan of everybody being historians.
So you're going to be doing some podcasts, aren't you?
Yes. Aren't I brave?
You are brave. We've already had the conversation about popping sounds and, you know, soft furnishings in a room. But so what do you hope to, what's the plan? Tell me the plan.
Well, the plan is that I'm I'm a huge fan of Twitter.
Yeah.
And I have a birthday month. So I don't have a birthday. I have a birthday month, which is August.
Okay, summer girl.
So I basically sort of say, well, the whole of August, you know, you all need to treat me like a queen, basically, because it's my, you know, it's like, my husband just looks at me as if,
so it goes
excessive.
On and on.
It goes
and
exactly,
on.
Yeah. Okay. So, darling, that's a bit excessive. You know. Anyway, so last year I decided for my birthday month to do an A to Z garden history. Mm-hmm. So I posted, so every day from the 1st of August to the end, I posted, starting with A, obviously, which was American Gardens. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, because you're limited in your number of characters, so it was actually hell of a challenge.
It's difficult, isn't it?
Because I had to also credit any photos that I used. Gosh, yes. And, you know, but I managed it because I used quite a few of my own as well. And so many people enjoyed that. You know, I was getting emails, I was getting, you know, saying, hello. So I thought, what about doing a podcast? Mm. So in the next couple of weeks, I will be launching the Garden History podcast.
And I will be listening for the sound quality, no pressure.
Yes, thanks for that.
Yeah.
So I've sort of written my content because obviously, again, it has to be quite tight. And
yeah. And it's you talking, you're not interviewing people, it's
no.
You. Yeah.
It's just me, as my husband said, me rambling on. And I've really enjoyed doing that because, again, I'm hoping to interest people again in garden history. And I've introduced it as on my Twitter as have a peek into garden history because it's such a fascinating subject. I'm so passionate about it. You know, just have a look and see. And so, yes, I'm looking forward to.
And I think with a podcast, people can sort of drop in. They're not feeling like they have to commit to, you know, buying a book or anything. It's more about just pop in.
Exactly.
Take a listen and they'll get hooked, I'm sure.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. Anyway, so that's what I'm going to do. And then I'll just see how it goes from there. But I'm quite excited about it because I would, if somebody had said to me a year ago that I would be launching a podcast, I would have just laughed like a drain, basically, because, you know, it took me about 3 years to get on Twitter. I mean, I've been on it for quite a while, but my...
You're doing well.
The thing is that my husband, he's the one that sort of nudges me, and he'll say, why don't you do this? And I'll say, oh,
brilliant.
God, no! And so he will put an idea in my head, and he'll just walk away. And then a year, 2 years, it'll be like, what do you reckon if I did this? Do you think
so he likes you to think it's your idea.
I think there's an element of that.
Yeah, I think he's a very clever man.
Sneaky,
yeah, very sneaky. It's been rumbled.
Anyway, so the podcast was, he mentioned this a while ago. And I said, oh, no, I couldn't possibly. Oh, and here I am.
There you are. Now, was he the one that pushed you into doing TV presenting? So we all tuned in. Anyone that knew you tuned into Garden as well. Was that October? It was last year, wasn't it?
It was last year. They featured my garden in the June.
Yeah.
And then I did a feature.
So how
in
did they
October.
Find you? Was that through Twitter or just through connections? Or?
No, they again, like I said, things happen to me. I never go... looking for any of this. And they'd approached me a couple of years ago, but there was an awful lot going on. I just, you know, didn't sort of go with it. And so we chatted, and as I say, I just couldn't commit to anything. Mm. And then they approached me again at the beginning of last year. And everything had sort of settled down quite a lot by then. I thought, well, why not? Why not? And so I just had a chat with them. I was quite alarmed because when I turned up at the BBC, there were 5 of them.
Oh, 1 against 5.
Yes, so that was a bit alarming. But hey, you know
but
what?
It is nerve-wracking, isn't it? You know, you must have had sort of knots in your stomach thinking, what are they going to ask me to do? Will I be able to do it? Do you strike me as a confident person, but are you? Is that, is it easy for you to step in front of the camera, or is it something you...
No.
Right.
My confidence comes from preparation.
Okay.
I will not... I think I have a serious, serious case of imposter syndrome.
Right.
And therefore, to counteract that, to combat that, I have to know. So if I'm giving a lecture, all the facts that I give, I have double-checked, triple-checked. Yeah. If I am happy with the content of what I am doing, what I'm saying, then...
Your confidence comes.
My confidence comes. It's when I haven't prepared properly, or I think I haven't prepared something.
So you're never going to wing it. That's not you.
No.
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 But I think with your subject, you can't, can you?
No, you can't.
Because there's always someone that will go, oh, that date was incorrect, or yes. I know different.
Oh, yes. We, people sort of in my circle, we have these conversations about, question time at the end of a lecture.
Yeah.
Has anybody got any questions? And, and you get someone saying, well, this isn't actually a question. It's more of a comment. Oh no.
I know. Or you sort of get, I had once a gentleman said, I'd like to take issue with slide number 4. And you think, but it is. I don't think people realise. I mean, you and I obviously love giving talks. It's so exciting, but it is nerve-wracking.
Yes.
And I think people assume you're in the media, you can take it.
Yes.
But it isn't like that, is it? It is quite...
I have to say, I try and... My sense of humour helps, to sort of gets me out of holes quite a lot, is that I just, you know, I try not to take things too seriously if I can. And in fairness, I always learn something. When I give a talk...
Yeah.
I learn something from somebody in the audience. So I'm not, you know, I'm not too sort of dismissive about somebody saying, oh, this is a comment. And I actually, and I will say, you know, if somebody says to me, well, I think that's incorrect. And I will sort of say, well, is it? You know, can you tell, you know.
Some facts, because yeah. I am Sherlock Holmes. And I need the facts to be correct.
And I need the facts. And so, and, or somebody, I've done talks before. Because archery, the elite sport of archery is something else.
Oh, gosh, I really wanted to ask you about this. Now, I've got a question. Now, my father told me he lost a finger. He was in Korea and he lost a finger.
I know what you're going to ask, yeah.
Yeah, so he would always say, you know, that if someone put two fingers up to you, that was because they were basically saying, look, I can still pull my arrow.
Yeah.
I've got both my fingers. Is that right?
I have heard that. It was basically the French, that was their punishment. If you sort of caught an archer, would take those fingers off. I don't believe it.
I like it though, don't you?
It is actually quite an interesting, I think it's an apocryphal story, isn't it? But it is interesting, isn't it? Make sense.
Yeah, but why archery? Is it because it's part of big landscapes and...
Well, again, like I said to you, things happen to me.
They seem to.
Things happen to me. When I was doing my garden history MA, I was writing my dissertation. I decided to write about a local estate, not very far from here, and it had Rococo landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of wrote about that and the family, and it was absolutely fascinating. I loved it. But I came across a diary. Now, that's the other thing. Garden history. Oh, my goodness me. You get to read diaries and journals and commonplace books. Mm. You get to read letters, which is probably why, because letters are very difficult to sort of digitize. You know, if you've got 150 letters, because they wrote so many letters in those days, you know, they would write 4 or 5 letters a day. You know, they didn't have anything else better to do. And that's how they gossiped. They were full of gossip, you know, about who's doing what and what. Anyway, I came across this diary of Lady Williams Wynne. And she started talking about the lady of the house of the estate I was writing about becoming a lady paramount to the Royal British Bowmen Society. And I thought, hey, what? What's all that about? Anyway, and of course my deadline was looming. And I actually put a footnote in my dissertation sort of saying it would appear that archery was an elite sport. It was very important for the aristocracy. However, this is a subject that needs further research.
Investigation.
And I actually put that as a footnote when I mentioned archery lawn in my, I should say. So after I'd finished my dissertation, I went back to the subject that it was like a modern day dating agency.
Never. Go
honestly,
on, like speed dating.
Tinder. It's because, seriously, because it was for, you know, the top 1%.
Yeah.
And they held these bow meetings in their estates because they had this beautiful, you know,
so
rugged landscape.
Off.
And it was a safe way for young men and young women to meet because their families were there.
And they'd got a weapon in their hand.
What?
Don't overstep the boundary. I've got a bow and arrow.
And, of course, when the females were shooting...
Oh, they looked rather resplendent, didn't they?
Absolutely.
Like peacocks.
Oh, absolutely. Oh. And, of course, it was such an exclusive affair. You know, no servants were allowed to stay, nobody. It was totally, you know, private affair. And you'd have 200 people there, and they'd be fed, they'd be watered, you'd have lunch, you'd have singing, you'd have all sorts of things. And, I mean, have you ever read Daniel Deronda,
no.
George Eliot?
No.
In there, Gwendolyn Harleth, the heroine, spends hours choosing her archery dress because what's-his-face, Grand Court or whatever is going to be.
How
this
fabulous.
Was a thing. They had archery dresses. They had, because women weren't allowed to exercise.
No. But
Whereas that
was acceptable.
Shooting and walking to your target and back again. And that was a form of exercise.
It was like a sort of catwalk then. How wonderful.
I love
that
it.
That is so
I
good.
Love
now,
it.
I wanted to mention female gardeners because I saw a picture of, I don't know if you've heard, Nora Lindsay, who was a designer from Mottis. And she was stunning.
Absolutely.
It's like looking back at sort of what people wore. You look at our modern day garden designers, no disrespect to any of my lovely friends, but these women were just like movie stars.
Absolutely.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I've actually got her book up there. And the thing is that, as far as Nora Lindsay is concerned, she was a socialite.
Yeah.
She went into garden design because she had to do something. When she divorced her husband, she found that she didn't have any money. And so she had to do something. And because she was very, very, very friendly with the American expats who had a lot of money and also royalty. And so she just started doing this and she would stay at people's houses for months on end. And
see, that's what I find lovely. You know, nowadays we dash around, don't we? I've come to podcast you. I've got to dash off somewhere. But years ago, I would have arrived on my horse and cart and you'd have had to put up with me for a week.
Yeah, if not more.
Yeah,
you,
I mean,
you would have been a house guest. You would have been there. And, you know, the whole country house sort of party kind of thing where people descended. And they had all day, every day, to do their own thing, whether it's archery, croquet, hunting, fishing, tennis, when it sort of became more popular. You know, and then they'd all convene sort of for tea and then the evening's entertainment and what. And this went on for, you know, days. And so, and that's what she did. But she then advised people on their gardens. Mm. And I actually think that Nora Lindsay was a lot more influential than people give her credit for.
I mean, it was really only that I hadn't heard much about her, but I just saw this beautiful woman. And
then she's gorgeous.
Wow.
Absolutely gorgeous. Yeah, I think she has, her legacy has been very much overshadowed, sort of with Sissinghurst, Hidcote,
and,
you know, that kind of thing. I think she was actually very, very talented. Mm. And I actually like her style of planting. Well, very sort of very romantic, sort of romantic chaos. Mm. That's my garden. Yeah. Lots of roses and lots of, if something sells seeds, I'll sort of look at it and think, yeah, all right. Yeah, you look all right there. You can stay.
Did you grow up with a garden? Were your parents gardeners?
No.
Really? So are they quite surprised by what you've done?
Oh, my parents are just, they're amazed. I mean, there's an awful lot of shaking of heads, especially sort of the television thing. Is it, why? No, but my grandfather on my father's side was a very, very keen gardener. He was very, very
so
good.
So somewhere
it
in
is,
your genes?
It is in my genes. And because my father, well, my parents kept saying, where's this come from? Almost like it's a disease or something.
It
where's
is
it
funny, though, with
from?
Gardening, isn't it? You know, I've got gardening relatives, but I've heard other gardeners say, my parents are at a loss where I've got this mad idea. It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very
absolutely.
Strange.
But I just do, I love my garden, I love plants. And as I say, I'm a sort of a chaotic, romantic gardener. And I love things that sell seed because things that are, they find their own.
Yeah. And they normally
place,
do
and
very
they
well.
Thrive, you know, instead of trying to force something into a particular space. And then you find, I had an erodium, which literally walked out of the border over 3 years. It walked out of the border and flourishes in a crack in the sort of, just
and you
off
think,
the park.
Why did I ever bother plant you with such care?
Well, the things are obviously, and I think it's sort of one of those things that likes really good drainage and sort of doesn't like, sort of, so I think, well, okay, as long as you're not in my way, as long as you're not like...
as long as I'm not going to trip over you with my archery bow.
Then that's fine. And so things find where they're happiest and, you know, as long as they're
and
not...
And you have with your career, obviously.
Yeah, I have.
Because you seem ever so content with what you're doing.
Oh, I love it. It's a privilege. It is a privilege because, you know, I'm never going to be a millionaire. But being paid to do what you love, what you enjoy. I mean, sometimes I think to myself, goodness me, you know, is this really work? When we went to sort of my Thomas Birch Freeman stuff, we went to Ghana to look at his family archives at the public records office there. And again, this is my husband sort of saying, well, yeah.
Let's go. You know,
so when I was in the archives, in sort of, so I tried to split my days so that I was in the archives sort of for about 4 or 5 hours. And then he just went off with his camera and just did his own thing while I was in the archives and then we'd meet up back at the apartment. You know, and I'm thinking, at some stage, I'm going to get paid for this.
But
and
also, it's
wonderful.
Costing you, though, isn't it? Because you travel quite a lot, don't you?
It's an investment, I suppose.
Yeah, so you've got to not think, oh, crikey, you know. It's driven by passion, isn't it?
It is. And the thing is, if you are passionate about something, you tend to get people on board. I mean, I was absolutely amazed when the Methodist church actually gave me access to his journals, because they're, I mean, there's one which I don't think I'll ever be able to have a look at. It's in, they're in such a fragile condition. And so this is what I was looking at when I was in London a couple of days ago. So I just take photographs and then transcribe them when I get home. You know, when people are happy to support you and allow giving you access to this, it's like the archivists in Accra. You know, I'd been corresponding with them for nearly 2 years trying to sort of find the information, you know, so when I finally turned up there and they had all this stuff for me and they, you know, and you just think, wow.
Is it language barriers with researching people from far and wide? Are you a linguist?
I don't think so. Although I do still speak my mother tongue, because I was born in Zimbabwe.
Right.
So, you know, as a family, we speak Shona.
Yeah.
And, no, I don't.
You get round it.
You just get round it. I mean, it's like the Italian Renaissance things. And I mean, when I was researching the various gardens that I talk about, obviously, again, we sort of up sticks and went on,
yeah,
you know, had a look. And of course, because English is quite an international language, you can get round.
You can get by.
Yeah, you can normally find somebody who is just as enthusiastic as you are and speaks English, so you can...
So when you're not reading, writing, researching, do you do anything else? Is there anything... what's your hobby? Garden history.
Gardening, I think, is what I do. Yes, I think gardening, because I sort of... My year sort of rotates round my reading, writing, research and gardening. So I will spend months writing a lecture, and then it's at a certain stage I record it on my dictaphone. I'm then able to listen to myself, and while I'm doing that, I go out in the garden.
So you're already podcasting, you see. You have been for a long time. When you think
to
about
myself,
it,
yes.
But you're the only listener.
Oh, that's true. Yeah,
so you're a pro already.
So I record myself, and then I will go out in the garden and I'm listening to what I'm saying, and I can actually make mental notes.
Yeah.
And then when I come back into the study, I then re-listen to the dictaphone and edit my lecture.
Okay.
According to what I have been listening to. And I think, well, that doesn't sound right. Well, that's not relevant. You don't need that information in there. You need to expand on this.
Mm.
You need to. And then that's how I sort of.
Yeah. So what's your big ambition then? Is there something you're dying to do? Maybe write a book on someone or find out something about someone.
I want to write my book on my Mr. Freeman.
Freeman. Good.
That is my ultimate goal, because the man is. He is fascinating. He really is absolutely fascinating. The records at Kew, the pre-1840 records at Kew, were destroyed, unfortunately, because I have very, very strong suspicions and a little bit of wobbly evidence to point he was actually apprenticed at Kew. I think he learnt...
But you've got to find that out.
Yeah, I think he had a benefactor, because if you think about it, you've got this little, you know, biracial, mixed race boy he was born in 1809.
Mm.
He became a head gardener at a huge estate.
I mean, that's quite remarkable.
At the age of 24?
Yeah.
And this family that he was working for were horticulturalists.
Yeah, and somebody must have really nurtured him, mustn't they?
I mean, he was a botanist. You know, he knew about insects. His journal, travelling to Accra, he notes longitude, latitude, you know, the stars. He talks about, you know, the temperatures at such a place and this. And as they were passing various islands, he said, well, we saw this, we saw that. And he was so knowledgeable. And where did he get this knowledge from? Yeah. I mean, I know Victorians are famous for being self-taught. They, you know, you have an awful lot of famous people that just acquire their knowledge themselves. But it's quite intriguing. That is my burning.
Well, my burning ambition for you is to turn that into a movie.
Oh, I already know who I want to play him.
Oh, go on, who is it?
No, I'm not saying.
I think I might be able to guess.
No, you wouldn't. Nobody would. I saw him in a drama a couple of years ago, and I said to my husband, I said, see that bloke there? He would make a perfect Thomas Birch Freeman. He even looks like him.
Well,
anyway, so wouldn't that be fabulous?
That would be just the icing on the cake.
That would be amazing.
And I can see you walking down a catwalk. Walking down your premiere with your beautiful headscarf. That's my ambition for you. Only small dreams here.
Small dreams.
Small dreams. Anyway,
but as I said, that's a slow burn
sort
of ambition. So I've got quite a few other projects in the meantime. So
Brilliant.
You know, I'll be carrying on with those.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you. And, you know, you are really inspiring and making garden history very relevant for all of us now. So thank you for that.
It's for everybody. And the more people that know about garden history, social history, the better we'll all be. Yes.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been good fun.
Adfully kept me hooked, and I simply love the stories about dating linked to archery, and her take on garden history is so refreshing. I also rather adored her idea of having a birthday month. In my next podcast, I meet Jack Wilgoose of Wild Goose Nursery in Shropshire. Until next time, happy gardening. Fresh from the Pod is presented by me, Tamsin Westhorpe, and produced by Candide in their plant-filled Bristol office. Candide is a free plant and gardening app with a helpful community of plant lovers, interesting articles and great tools like plant identification and garden tours. Ask a question in the app with the hashtag #FreshFromThePod and I'll choose my favourite to answer later in the series. And if you enjoyed Fresh From The Pod, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, share it on Reddit and talk about it with your friends. And don't forget to subscribe.